And I certainly have recovered from this hopeless state of mind. Can y'all see me, or is it a big black thing in front of me? Anyway, I'm going to step to the side. How's that? First of all, I want to thank God for God, because without Him, just for the recording, that was not me. I'd like to say thank you, God, for being God. And when I say God, I mean the spirit of the universe. That's my higher power. It's just easier to say God instead of the spirit of the universe, which is what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, which I am a member of, Cocaine Anonymous, because they allowed me to choose my power, because my power wasn't working for me at all. I don't know if it did for you guys, but we obviously wound up in the same place together. So I was born in Houston, Texas. Right on. But I didn't stay there long. I moved to a little country town called Klein, Texas, which was a little dot on the map, but one of the fastest growing cities in the nation in the late 60s, early 70s. I was sexually abused as a child, and so that put a lot of shame and a lot of guilt on me, and I became a liar because I chose and made a choice to not share that with anyone. So I held it in for a very, very, very long time. I don't blame that for my alcoholism, but it had a little bit to do with it. Because from a very, very early age, I knew that I was different. I just knew that I was different. Nothing fit in my life. I didn't have a whole lot of friends, and I didn't get along with my family very well. So I just felt like I was over here. I just didn't fit in very well. So I grew up like that. I grew up not fitting in until I needed to fit in. I tell people that I was sober for 15 years, and then I started getting drunk and high. So I had 15 years of sobriety, and then I started. And I went on and on to the bitter end for myself. My sobriety date is February 19th of the year 2000. And for that, I am eternally grateful, and I get goosebumps when I say that. But the truth is all I have is today. And if y'all got up before 8:30 this morning, then y'all have more sobriety than I do today. And that's how I truly believe this. This is my one day at a time track in this journey of life. So I went to Klein High School on and off because I couldn't make it to class very often at all. I chose to skip school and go and get high and just stay high. And that was the beginning of my journey. At 17 years old, I dropped out of high school and married the town drug dealer. Yeah. And back then, we could buy a pound of marijuana for like $80. We'd drive to Austin and buy it, and then we'd go home and make lids and sell them for 10 bucks. And we were high rollers. So, and that marriage lasted about 3 years on and off. You know, we were coming and going in each other. And at the time, I thought I knew everything there was to know about being married and about being an adult, and I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing. So I left that small country town. And when I say country, it was country. I was the girl that got in the truck with the girls and the guys, and we'd go and shoot shotguns at stop signs. You know, have you seen the signs with the holes in them? I don't know if people do that anymore, but that was the big excitement for a Friday and Saturday night. I went to Houston. I moved to Houston, and I moved in with two of my brother and my cousin. And well, two of my cousins, actually. And it was the den of inequity. We were all getting high and getting drunk. At those times, You could go every night of the week. There was a ladies' night, and ladies drank free, so this lady was there. And I wasn't much of a lady, trust me. I was a drunk. From the first time that I really drank alcohol, I got drunk. And I stayed drunk for many years. I started doing cocaine when I was about 24 years old. And I didn't stop until I was 45. So I had a long run with drugs and alcohol. I don't want to stay in the problem because we all know what that looks like. We all know what waking up in the morning and wondering, what do I got to do? How do I got to do it? And who do I have to do it to get what I need to put into my body? Because I have this disease that says, I got to do this. And it's in my mind. It's centered in my mind. And the obsession kicks in, and I can't stop until I put something in my body to change the way I feel. And I didn't even really know what feelings were until about 3 years into sobriety, if you want me to be honest. My sponsor would say to me, how do you feel? And I'd go, I feel like shit. And she would say, that's not a feeling. Okay. So literally, I had to get the word of feelings. And when I would have it in my back pocket, and she'd ask me, how do you feel? I feel grateful. I feel happy. I feel sad. So I learned these things in my sobriety. There's a lot of things I've learned in sobriety, and I'm truly grateful for that. I've learned how to have a relationship with the God of my understanding, and it grows intensely. The more I work on it, the more I ask for help, the more I get blessings. I started, I was divorced, moved to Houston, worked, and did drugs and alcohol for many, many years. Then I met this man, and he was an older man, and he had lost his wife, and I kind of befriended him. Okay, let me get honest. I took him as a victim, okay? And I didn't have to work for a very long time because he took care of me. Isn't that a lovely way of saying that my life was a shithole and I had to place my dependency on another human being? That man died, left me a little bit of money, so I moved to Austin, Texas. And I was having fun in Austin, and I got a DWI in Houston with a little slap on the wrist. Then I moved to Austin and followed that DWI up with two more. I never really had any problems because I had money and I could pay to get an attorney and get out of it. I didn't have any complications, so to speak. I think I was on probation for the third DWI for like 6 months, and then I just paid my complete fine up front and never would show up to the probation office again, so, which did me no favors. Please know that, because I have 3 DWIs, but I should have like 3,000, because I don't believe that I ever drove sober. When I was drinking, I don't think I was ever sober. Maybe in the beginning, but at the end of the night, there was no sobriety in this life. And so, you know, I guess I'm lucky. The odds were in my favor that I only got 3 DWIs. So I moved to, get a call from my sister, my little sister, and she goes, hi, Aunt Cindy. And I wasn't an aunt, so she was her way of telling me she was having a child. So I thought, you know, I got nothing going on in Houston. So I moved to Austin 26 years ago. And that entire time, I'm doing nothing but getting high and staying drunk and occasionally working. I moved to Austin. I met a woman that I knew in Houston, and we started a little business together, property management business. And there's nothing in this world like being an alcoholic and a drug addict and working for yourself. because you don't have to go to work if you don't want to. So I wound up working till about 2 o'clock every afternoon when I'd show up. And then I'd go and get drunk. And, you know, I'd go to 6th Street. And I just stayed drunk all the time, and I stayed high. And I was extremely lonely. And I did not like who I was. Then I met the guy. Ooh. I met another guy. And should I say victim? Married him, and whom I thought was Mr. Right turned out to be Mr. Not So Right. So we divorced. Prior to us getting divorced, though, I found out that he was doing cocaine, and I was freaking appalled. How could he be doing that? He's working. He needs to support. So I paid for him. We paid for him to go to treatment in Hunt, Texas. And that was the first time that I'd ever been introduced to any kind of 12-step program. And I was determined that he was going to stay sober, which is insanity because I'm a drunk and I'm a drug addict, but he needs to be sober. So I started going to 12-step meetings with him to make sure that he would be there and he would get this. And the longer I sat in the rooms, the more you guys were talking about me. The things that you were saying, I'm going, y'all don't know me. How do you know my life? You didn't know that I did this, this, and this, and yet you were laughing about it. You were joyous, and you were sharing the truth, which is something that I never, ever shared in my entire life until I got sober. And some days still I tell lies. I got to be honest about that. So Mr. Not So Right didn't stay sober, but I stayed in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. And I haven't left yet. Now, what that looks like is, it was life-changing for me. And I smile when I say that because I was watching the Masters today, the last part of it, and I saw the guy that was putting on the 18th hole, the man says, and this will be his life-changing moment. And that's what happened to me when I came into Cocaine Anonymous. When I really came in and sat down in this seat and listened, that's when my life changed. I was going to Cocaine Anonymous because I'm a huge cocaine addict as well as an alcoholic. And at that time, it was a very, very small community. There was a couple of guys that had gone to that treatment center in Hunt, Texas, and came back to Austin and started a CA group. And so I kind of got in on the ground floor of Cocaine Anonymous here in the city of Austin. And the book doesn't lie when it says you will meet a host of new friends and you will watch this fellowship grow. That fellowship is unbelievable now. There were like four guys and about five girls that would go to the same meeting Sunday night, Thursday night, and Saturday night. So I became very close friends with the women that I was with. And the women that I started in Cocaine Anonymous with, we are all still sober by God's grace. And that's unbelievable because they were really sick. No, just kidding. When I first came into Cocaine Anonymous, I was the biggest liar I knew. I had lied all my life about everything. If you ask me what I had for lunch, I'd say a salad, knowing that I had a burger. You know, I made up lies just to lie. And I was in fear. And I never knew that I thought I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and I had a Wonder Woman suit on. Because I didn't think that I had any fears. I didn't really know what that meant, to be fearful. Until I got sober. And now I know that Fear is that evil and corroding thread that ties us all together, that binds me. Anytime today that I am angry, upset, all those feeling words, I know it's because I have some kind of fear. When I get upset with you, it's because you have touched a place in my heart that brings out some fear that I know about or did not know about. I started working the steps. None of the girls that I got sober with had ever worked all 12 steps. So what we did decide to do was the two guys and all the girls would get together on Saturday morning and we'd work the steps together. And I remember there was a guy named Jaime, and he had really long hair, and he was kind of easy on the eyes. And he asked me, was I working with anyone? And I didn't have a job. I said, no, I don't have a job. He goes, no, that's not what I mean. He goes, do you have a sponsor? And I said, I don't even know what that means. And then he goes, well, do you want to work with me? And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I can work with you. Oh, yeah. Little did I know what the hell he meant. But it was one of the greatest blessings of my entire life. I don't recommend that women work with men, but at that time, that's all I had. So that's what I did. This man took me through this book. This book is so ragged, it's falling apart, but it's my first book I ever had. Page by page, line by line, word by word. And if I didn't know a word, I had to pull out the dictionary and I had to look it up. And I had to write down what the word meant so I would remember. And I got a great foundation to what these 12 steps mean and how they can change your life. Still not really believing that I could change my life. I was sober about 45 days and driving to a meeting. And I realized that was the first time that I'd woke up that I'd been doing this deal. And I didn't think about drugs and alcohol. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, maybe this is possible. You know, some of this, it comes on really fast, like that burning bush that the book talks about. Me, it took a very long, slow process. So I came to believe in a power greater than myself. Then I turned my will over to that power. And when I did that, I knew that I couldn't turn back. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew that I had something for once in my life that I could hold on to and feel good about, and no shame and no guilt surrounding it. And therefore, I jumped in head first. And I worked the 12 steps with this gentleman. And he remained my sponsor for about a year and a half. Until I got out in the world, in the anonymous world, and started meeting some women that had something that I wanted and also something I needed, because I needed to sit with a woman. I can remember sitting with this gentleman after I did my first fourth step with him. And after I finished, I was so proud and so happy, and he looked at me and he said, "What did you leave off?" And being the good liar, I said, "Oh, absolutely nothing." And that's what I said. 2 days later, I called him. I said, yeah, we probably need to talk. So we get together, and I shared that one thing that I was taking to the grave with me that nobody would ever know about in my entire life, and I shared it with them. We were in a room, and I wanted to turn the lights off because I didn't want him to see me, and he said no. And I wanted to turn my back to him, and he said no. So I looked right at him, and I blurted out that one thing. And the son of a bitch laughed at me. He said, "That's it? Hell, I've done that." And I'm throwing. So if there is that one thing that you're holding on to, please know that it's probably not a surprise to most. Mine had something to do with an animal. So I'll just leave it like that. Whew. Yeah. Anyway, can't blame a girl for trying, I guess. I don't know. When I got to the fear inventory, I had two fears on my inventory. And because I'm such an egotistical maniac, of course it was all about me. I was afraid to drive down Interstate 35 because I was afraid that an airplane would drop down on me in the car that I was in driving down I-35. And I was afraid to drive on, I think it's Barton Springs, by that putt-putt place where they had that bridge with the train that went over it, because I was in fear that the train was going to fall on me. Those were my two fears. God almighty, little did I know that everything I do and said and breathed was fear-based. Needless to say, he laughed at that as well. I'm skipping around a little bit because I asked God to remove my defects of character. And the ones that I gave him, he kind of did, but I would grab them and take them back. I do the best of my ability today to live in 36 principles in my life. That's the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. And so the amends process was not pretty for me. And I looked and hunted and searched out everybody, even Janet Day, the girl I beat up in the fifth grade, I think. I had to find her, which I thought was impossible, but I'm surprised and amazed at a loving God of my understanding, because when I ask for things, it happens. How am I going to find a girl that I... It happened. She didn't remember it, which kind of pissed me off because I whooped her ass good. Or at least I thought I did. Then I got to 10, 11, and 12. And by that time, the two guys that started this meeting, we kind of decided that we wanted our place of our own. So we hunted around the city and found a place on the corner of crack and heroin, which is Runberg and Lamar. And we started Club 101. And on Friday nights, the girls that I got sober with, we decided that we were taking the message to all kinds of treatment centers, especially Austin Recovery, when they were over on Cameron Road. And we would invite the girls from that community to come, and they would always tell us, "Oh, we can't come because we have children." So what we decided to do was, we would babysit the girls that were the members, so to speak, of CA. We wanted everyone to come, so we invited the women with children, and we would babysit their children so they could hear the message. And that's a little meeting that God started through myself and four other women called Stepsisters, which on any given night, on a Friday night at 7:30, the room is SRO. There's probably 125 women in that room, and it's God. It's God. So if you get a chance, come see us. Not this half of the room, sorry. We have a primary purpose. I started getting involved in Cocaine Anonymous. So we started this meeting, and then we started going to district meetings. And I got involved with that, not because I wanted to, but because my sponsor made me. And from that, then I started going statewide and talking to people and getting to know people in Cocaine Anonymous, because the fellowship was growing so quickly. today I'm involved with Cocaine Anonymous and have been since the first day that I walked into the rooms. And I'm extremely blessed to be able to work with Cocaine Anonymous on a world level. So, which really means that I volunteer, but really I'm just voluntold what to do when I show up. And I'm willing to do that because I was willing to go to any length to get sober. I needed to get sober badly. I was dying. I was 45 years old. I was extremely overweight. I've lost a lot of weight since I got sober, and I continue to work on myself. I try to the best of my ability to practice these principles in all my affairs, and I do a pretty good job at it. But what I do know is that the women that I got sober with are the women that love me the most. Those are the women that can look me in the eye and tell me I'm a liar. I'll explain. When I first got sober, I was going to this meeting, and Mr. Not So Right and I had separated, and so I left him. I was homeless. I did have a car, and I was sleeping on someone's couch. But I'd go into the meetings, and I would talk like, I'm doing great, y'all, and God is so good, and he's working in my life, and he's doing everything for me, and I have no problems in my entire life. I'm homeless, going through a divorce, just about to lose everything. So one day, one night after the meeting, this girl walked up to me and she goes, why are you lying to these people? And I looked at her and I was appalled. What are you talking about? I'm just being honest. And she said, no, you're not. You got a car that's a damn hoopty. You don't have a job. And I don't ever see you praying or meditating. And what I wanted to do was to retaliate. And my retaliation is usually hitting and fighting. But I couldn't because I was sleeping on her couch. So I had to step back and look at that and think, why am I still being fake? Why am I being dishonest? Why can't I just be me? And it's because I didn't like who I was. I didn't even love who I was. I didn't know anything about me because I had pushed down everything for so many years. And when someone loves you enough to tell you the truth, you should probably maybe, I should maybe pay attention a little bit. And I'm grateful that those women are still in my life. And they're still calling me on my stuff. And they don't co-sign on my bullshit. Which is what I normally would do, would go from person to person to person. So they would say, yeah, you're right. And then I'd go, of course I'm right. And walk away. And be justified at the lies in my head. The best thing that I know about this book, and if I've said anything that does not coincide with this book is right and I am wrong. But what it did teach me to do was to have a relationship with a power greater than myself. And what that looked like in the beginning was I'd get on my knees and say, God, please. And at the end of the night, I'd say, thank you. And that's really what it looked like in the beginning. And then I found that if I opened these books, I remember my sponsor in the beginning told me, Cindy, the book says as Bill sees it, not as Cindy sees it. So the little truths were hitting me in the face, and I had to deflate my ego, which was huge. It's about me, for me, it's about listening to people that love me enough and care about me enough to tell me the truth. Most importantly, though, it's about listening to the message that I get from my power, from the spirit of the universe. And I do that in many ways. In the morning, when I wake up, I push the button on the coffee machine and go outside and spend time with God. I'm a very early riser. I choose to be at work at 6 o'clock in the morning so I can get off early. That's the only reason. So I get up about 4:45 in the morning, except on the weekends I sleep late. And I make time in the morning to connect with this power. One of the greatest gifts for me in my life has been little meditation books, whatever they look like. My newest one is called Jesus Calling. It's a great book for me in my life today. I read things that I don't ever think about. And the truth is everything that I do think about is something that somebody's already ever told me. I don't have very many original thoughts in this head. This morning, for instance, this book says, all you got to do is call my name. And I'm in your presence. He tells me in the pages of this book that I'm like sand on a desert blowing in the wind. You know, I can't settle down. But when I do settle down and when I do get in the presence of, then I can feel that love, that love that I've never felt before. In October, my father passed away. My dad was my hero. My dad was the one that always said, Cindy, come on and go to church with me. And I always had an excuse, like, oh, Dad, I don't have anything to, you know, I didn't bring anything to wear. And he would say, God don't care what you look like. He just wants to see you. So I keep that in my heart, what my dad says to me. But I kind of got... I'm not going to say depressed because I prayed for God to take my father because it was not the man that I knew. He had Alzheimer's, and I knew that he was miserable in this life, and I wanted him to go on. But I became reclusive in my home. I didn't go to meetings for about 15, 20 days. I didn't answer the phone. I didn't watch the Spurs. That's a big thing for me. And what it did do for me was to go deep into this book and other books that I read as well to help understand the power of the love of the God of my understanding. It brought me so much closer. It's like catapulted me into the fourth dimension, which the book talks about. And I haven't stopped yet. I want to keep going, and I want to keep going. So what I do today, and this is only recent, and I've been sober 18 years, y'all, is I seek out. I seek out the word, the written word from scholars. You know, there's so many beautiful books out there and so many types of spiritual ways to reach a God of your own understanding. Mine is mostly through prayer and meditation. I do sit on the weekends when I have time and listen to music and then just write down thoughts, which are not my thoughts. They're the thoughts of a loving God to help others and to do what I can do when I can do it, which is often. I threw myself into Cocaine Anonymous because I had nothing else to throw myself into. I knew that if I kept on, that I was going to be one of the three, jails or institutions or dead. I knew that. I have a job today that I go to every day, except when I don't, which is rarely. I stay accountable to my sponsor and to the women that I know in this program. But that accountability lost me. Okay, let me say that differently. I pulled away from that accountability when my father passed away, because I don't know what really came over me. The truth is that I didn't mourn, I didn't cry, and I was angry at myself for not being able to feel those feelings that I'm supposed to feel. What I thought I was supposed to feel. So what I learned was I'm exactly where I need to be at all times, no matter what, no matter what the circumstance. We are all here together tonight for a reason. I believe that. Unconditionally, I just believe that nothing in this world happens by circumstance. Cocaine Anonymous has changed my life in many ways. I get to go to their conference, which is, if any of you have been to like a group conscience on a group level, this is like a group conscience on steroids, where people from all over the world come and they make decisions about the business of Cocaine Anonymous. And I probably could say that in my life, it's very difficult for three people that I know to come to the same conclusion. But when you come together with over 150 people from all over the world working for the primary purpose of Cocaine Anonymous, it's kind of difficult and loving at the same time. I guess what I'm trying to say is God gave me the opportunity to prove to myself that I'm worthy, that I'm a good human being, that I love myself. And I couldn't ever say any of those things because I just wasn't. I'm a fighter and I'm a drunk and I have a foul mouth. God has given me everything that I've asked for. And when I say that, He has three answers for me. The answer is yes, no, or wait. So sometimes I have to wait, but I do get an answer to everything. And I have to remind myself to be careful what I pray for. In early sobriety, I remember, God, please help me be patient and tolerant with other people. So you go to the grocery store and you get in the longest line and they're like, I need a price check on aisle 7. And I'm getting angry and I can feel it. And then I'm reminded that I prayed for patience and tolerance today. And this is the way I get to learn this. Those are simple little things that I find it's the small things that if I pay attention to the small things, that changes my life. If you're struggling for any reason in this program, please talk to someone. Don't hold it in. It's the worst thing we can do is hold it in. And the hardest damn thing for us to do is to ask for help. Because after all, we're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. This is a great place. I worked at Austin Recovery. I was like 10 months sober when they hired me. And I worked for them for 10 years. And this is truly where the healing begins. And I believe that in my heart. I often say that God took this good-for-nothing woman who now allows her to do good for nothing, which means that I do a lot of volunteer work. I go a lot of places. I meet a lot of people that are just like me. And if it's at all possible, I try my best to speak to everyone I see. I would talk to this board if I thought it talked back to me. Because I'm all about trying. I'm a miracle of God because my life has changed. And God has given me a blessing that I can change people's lives just by smiling. Just by smiling at someone, you can change their life. Believe me when I say that. I can tell you that if you're struggling, please don't get up and walk out. Please wait for the miracles to happen, because they do. And they don't happen quickly in most lives, especially mine. But God could and would if he were sought. And that's what our journey is. My journey is to seek him in everything I see and do. I hope that part of this might have made some sense. I don't know. But please know that I love each and every one of you. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here. And thank y'all for being loving and kind and listening to me.